This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last month, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos scrapped a key part of government policy governing campus sexual assault. She rescinded two sets of guidelines put in place by the Obama administration. DeVos said she was giving colleges and universities more freedom to balance the rights of accused students with the need to crack down on serious misconduct. The Trump administration said the Obama rules lacked basic elements of fairness, but opponents of the rollback believe this will reduce protections for assault victims and discourage victims from speaking out. We take a closer look at both arguments and both policies this hour. Sarah Brown is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education who writes about a range of higher ed topics, including sexual assault. She joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Good morning. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Attorney John Gresham is with Tin, Fulton, Walker, and Owen and has represented a number of male students accused of sexual misconduct at UNC, ASU, Duke, Davidson, and Queens University of Charlotte. He's in our studio. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
Andy Clark is executive director and co-founder of End Rape on Campus, a rape survivor advocacy group. She is also at NPR. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Sarah Edwards is in our studio with John Gresham. She's Associate General Counsel at UNC Charlotte. Welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Mike.
As we go through the program, you may have questions or comments. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, where we're broadcasting on Facebook Live this morning, and you can get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talk. So let's start with the Obama-era guidelines. Sarah Brown, these are only a few years old. I think 2011 is when they came into being, if I'm not mistaken. Why did the Obama administration take that action at that time?
Right. So what we're talking about here is the 2011 Dear Colleague Letter. So that was a document issued in April 2011 by the Obama administration's Department of Education. And, you know, this wasn't the first time that the department had told colleges that they needed to be responding promptly and equitably to reports of sexual assault. It was more of a sort of strongly worded reminder that these are your obligations under Title IX, which is the federal gender equity law. And it was sort of in response to the fact that, you know, in the eyes of many students in particular who were speaking out at the time and telling their stories of being sexually assaulted, that colleges were sweeping these cases under the rug, that they weren't believing victims, that they weren't taking them seriously, weren't completing investigations promptly. So that's sort of the sort of environment in which this Dear Colleague letter was issued. And it did say, while there weren't necessarily a lot of new obligations in the letter, it did say there are a few specific things that colleges are expected to do in order to comply with Title IX. You know, you should be using this standard of evidence when you're determining whether a student has committed a sexual assault. You know, you should have a designated employee on campus who's responsible for handling Title IX issues. So that sort of thing.
And I want to hear from both Andy Clark, who's the co-founder of End Rape on Campus, and John Gresham, who's an attorney who has represented people who have been accused of this, about the impact of these Obama regulations over the last 6 years. How would you describe, Andy, their impact?
Yeah, exactly like Sarah said, this is important to know that this wasn't new. It was a very strongly worded reminder of schools' obligations to follow the laws. And it was in English, in plain English, that students could understand what their rights were. And so it had a tremendous impact in students being able to hold their schools accountable for not following best practices. And so the rollback, I think, sends a very clear leadership signal that this administration might not be as interested and protecting the rights of all students.
John, how would you describe the impact?
The impact was with many schools that they were so afraid of what the department may do because there was language in the Dear Colleague letter that said, "Dear colleague, we can cut off your federal funding if you don't do what we ask you to do."
And so she just mentioned plain English. Was that in plain English?
Yes. And I think every administration of every college and university in this country understood that.
Sarah Edwards, we have two Sarahs here this morning. You're with UNC. You're Associate General Counsel there. What do you see as the impact? What has been the impact in your mind at UNC Charlotte?
Well, I will say, I mean, clearly this guidance in the Obama administration, it made us think really hard about the way that we were processing these cases. And so
And when you thought about it, were you doing things that you thought in retrospect were not the wisest things to do? Has this improved how you've handled this in your mind?
I think that it has. I mean, I think that I don't think that we were necessarily handling them inappropriately beforehand, but these are very difficult and sensitive cases. And I think the more that we were told and the more information we had about the effect that these cases were having on both of the students, on the accused student and on the victim or survivor, I think we were able to make some changes that better supported both students.
We've done several programs on this. We did them in light of the Steer colleague letter coming out years ago, and a lot of colleges and people from colleges were on the program, and it was apparent that they had to change the way they were regarding this, and a lot of other people have done stories on this. Do you think the way UNC Charlotte handled these things and the way the UNC system handled these accusations in the past was insufficient?
So to be honest, when I started practicing, the Dear Colleague letter had just come out.
Okay.
So I was helping us get up to speed. I was helping us get our processes changed. But my understanding from one of the big things I think that the Obama era guidance gave us was that survivors were more comfortable coming forward. And so I think a lot of times the university wasn't aware that issues were happening, and so we couldn't address them.
Of course, there are two sides to this coin, and the accusation has been made that the Obama regulations resulted in unfair treatment of defendants, people accused of rape on campus, and you've represented several people.
Yes, and it's not rape. Usually, it is sexual misconduct.
Define that to the best of your ability on the radio.
Folks who'd been dating for a while, back and forth between their two rooms. At some point, typically the female, there have been gay couples who have also raised issues, but it has been that. On a certain night, my fellow that I was with did something that I did not want him to do. And let me add one thing about UNC's policy, UNCC's. It is one of the best policies because North Carolina in 2013, the legislature passed legislation that with all of our state universities, the accused has a right to a counsel. And the council to participate. That is not true with the private colleges and universities across North Carolina. So I would say UNCC has done a very good job.
So Sarah Brown, as you've reported on this in the Chronicle of Higher Education, have you found that a preponderance of defendants who have complained that they were denied due process? Or is that always the complaint of a defendant who has to face any charge?
Yeah. So, I mean, what I've heard is that I wouldn't say that it's necessarily that, you know, a bunch more students are being found responsible for sexual assault now. I will say I think that the punishments have probably gotten more severe, and I think that's prompting some of these complaints and lawsuits and that sort of thing. So I think that, you know, colleges have faced a lot of pressure thanks to the pressure of particularly student activists to more often expel students who are found responsible of really serious sexual misconduct. And in the past, it wasn't the case that, I mean, a lot of schools were not actually expelling students. The University of Virginia, for example, never expelled anyone for years who was found responsible for sexual misconduct before 2011. So I think it's, you know, yes, accused students are generally going to be upset in general that they're found responsible. But I think what we're seeing now is that the punishments are in some cases being more severe, and because of that, they're more often filing suit and speaking out about unfair treatment in these cases.
Now, we've had some fairly high-profile cases on television with Rolling Stone, I think University of Virginia, where obviously it's turned out that the accuser, wasn't telling the whole truth here, but it all still put the people who were accused in a pretty sticky wicket. So Annie Clark, for years, these campus sexual misconduct activities went unreported because women felt that they would not be supported and, in fact, probably were not supported by administrations. Is this simply the pendulum swinging the other way? Do you see unfairness in the rules right now from the defendant's point of view, or do you think this is a good thing, what happened under the Obama administration?
I do. I think what the Obama administration did was try to level the playing field. I think it was very biased in favor of the accused. And we do live in a culture where you are more likely to be blamed than believed coming forward. And so what this did was level that. And, you know, in college right now, 1 in 5 women will experience sexual violence before they graduate, drop out, sometimes take their own lives. They will walk across that stage with the title of sexual assault survivor. And when we're talking about 1 in 5, 20% of our female population, that is a huge number. And yet we're giving equitable weight in media from the Department of Education, from the Office of Civil Rights, to this quote unquote other side.
We are living in a world that is very different from the one I grew up in, it seems to me. And sexual permissiveness seems to be, or at least one would, if you believe the literature and the movies and television shows, it's pervasive. And we live in a hookup culture, friends with benefits culture. How do you determine in a culture like that where certain sexual acts are just like shaking hands in some cases? How do you stop it? Where do you draw the line, and how do you determine the line has been drawn? I'm starting with you, Annie.
There's something called consent, and making sure that you get consent for every sexual act. That doesn't matter if you've been in a relationship with a person before. If you are going to engage in a sexual activity, you should have consent to do so. And if you can't ask or are unclear about what is about to happen, or you are intoxicated or not sober enough to say yes and say that this is something you would like to do, then you probably shouldn't engage in that behavior. And it's incumbent on the person initiating that behavior to ensure that they have consent from the other party.
So with every escalation in the moment, you have to ask, is this okay?
It's not very difficult. I'm not sure what the confusion is. But yes, prior sexual acts, whether if you're kissing, that doesn't mean you want to have sex. If you have dated somebody in the past, that does not mean you want to have sex.
John?
It is a very difficult thing to determine when two people are in a dorm room. Mm-hmm. They have been back and forth to dorm room for 3 months or 4 months. I will give you a case that was recently in the paper here, and that is the young lady comes to the young man's room at 2 a.m. in her pajamas and gets in bed with him. And he, believing, if one were talking about at least implied consent, mm-hmm. that there was consent to some activity, began at a very low level of sexual contact. She then complained. That case went to the district attorney's office, where it was subsequently dismissed because, given those sets of facts, the DA thought this is not a case that should be in court. Thank you.
So, you're welcome. So we're going to talk about a standard of proof and what these new regulations may mean going forward that Betsy DeVos has suggested. They haven't become rules yet, but the point of our argument is up right for discussion right now. It's Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Spectrum Center, presenting Italian tenor and classical recording artist Andrea Bocelli, A Concert for Valentines, Friday, February 9th. Tickets available now. More information at SpectrumCenterCharlotte.com. And David Weekly Homes, featuring Energy Saver Homes in its new Matthews communities, Eden Hall and Fullwood Station. Details and available inventory at DavidWeeklyHomes.com, an equal housing opportunity. Well, coming up tomorrow on this program, the search is on for Amazon's second North American headquarters, it set off a stampede among cities, hoping to lure the online retail giant. And Charlotte, of course, is among the herd. Our city has said it will aggressively pursue Amazon, but so will 100 other cities. The New York Times has called our effort a long shot. Others aren't ready to count us out. So we hear from the man leading the charge and others about our prospects tomorrow at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, what the White House wants as the price of saving DACA and the Dreamers, and the Democrats' response. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
That's On Point this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the rules changes, proposed rules changes when it comes to sexual conduct on college campuses and what to do about it, proposed by Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos and overturning previous rules by the Obama administration through a dear colleague letter, which many people are not familiar with. John Gresham is here, not the writer, but also an attorney with Tin Fulton, Walker and Owen, representing male clients on the other side of this issue. Sarah Edwards is Associate General Counsel of UNC Charlotte. Annie Clark joins us. She's the executive director and co-founder of End Rape on Campus. And Sarah Brown is a reporter who writes about all of this in the Chronicle of Higher Education. They're both in Washington with us this morning. The Obama administration rules demanded that colleges use the, quote, lowest standard of proof, a preponderance of the evidence, in deciding whether a student committed sexual assault. So I think this is being overturned by Betsy DeVos, but split hairs for me, John. What does preponderance of the evidence mean, and how does it differ from standards of proof used in other types of cases or in other courts or jurisdictions?
Well, there are three standards of evidence. If it's a criminal matter, it is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Isn't rape criminal?
Yes. And if you bring a charge, not to your school, but to the police or district attorney in your area, they will bring that charge if they believe that the evidence would support a case. So that is always available to any student who says that they have been subject to rape, something that's horrible and something that the district attorney would cover. Second standard is if you had a contract with somebody and you go to court, the court will decide, or the jury will decide, whether it's more likely than not that there was a contract or it was breached. There is a mid-standard called clear and convincing evidence, mm-hmm. which is sort of in between, and it is what UNC Chapel Hill used until the Dear Colleague letter came out, and the notion was that where you are going to impose severe penalties, expulsion from school, something on someone's record that will follow them if they try to go to another school or will follow them into their careers, that the clear and convincing evidence standard was the appropriate one. Now, the DeVos letter does not require colleges at this point to go to the clear and convincing standard. It says that they may, where the Dear Colleague letter said only the lower standard.
So the Obama, let's be clear about this. The Obama rules, I understand, and maybe demanded is too strong a word, but maybe it's
required,
accurate.
Required, I think.
Okay, required colleges use the lowest standard of proof. Do they require that because, Sarah Edwards, they were using even less than that prior to the Obama guidelines?
I don't think so. I think many colleges and universities were already using preponderance, but I think especially the ones in the upper tier were using clear and convincing. And so because they were using this higher standard, I think there was some concern that they were not appropriately addressing all of the complaints that came before them.
So Annie Clark, as John Gresham just said, under these new guidelines that Betsy DeVos has proposed, colleges have the discretion, I believe, to apply either the minimal standard, the preponderance of evidence standard, or the medium standard, clear and convincing evidence, both less rigorous than the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. Is this a bad thing in your mind?
Yes, I think it is. I think it gives schools permission by using that higher evidentiary standard to discriminate. And let's be clear about something.
How so?
The preponderance standard is something that is used in all other cases of civil rights law. And so taking out Title IX and making an exception would be creating a special class, first of all. Secondly, all of the other conduct violations, if, for example, somebody was physically assaulted, you hit somebody in the face, that would also go under preponderance. And so to say, if you hit somebody in the face and that person was previously in a relationship, how is that, and therefore they're allowed to use a higher standard, it doesn't really make any sense. And so preponderance is what we have case law and history for. And so to give schools permission to go higher for this one individual case is inconsistent with best practices and with current law.
But doesn't the onus fall on both sides equally? I mean, couldn't it be used by both sides equally, the accuser and the accused?
The problem is that it's not. And the system is weighted against the survivor or person reporting, especially with the other things that are in the new guidelines. So, for example, only the accused has the right to appeal. They took away the timeline in which an investigation must happen. And so with tipping the scales in favor of an accused student and having a higher evidentiary standard, this is stripping away rights.
What has been, Sarah Brown, the reaction? I know that this has just come out within the last several weeks, but what's been the reaction among institutions of higher education to these proposals?
So I've talked to a number of Title IX officers since the DeCarli letter was rescinded. I mean, at that point, they were basically saying, we are reviewing this guidance carefully, but we're not going to change our policies overnight. Changing campus policy is a very sort of lengthy process. Colleges spend a lot of time bringing their policies and procedures into line with the Obama administration policy on sexual assault. So at this point, I think most of them said, you know, we're going to stay the course. And you know, the reality on the ground is largely going to stay the same. I mean, at this point, that DeVos letter was interim guidance, and we're now going to go through a notice and comment process where the department will basically produce regulations on sexual assault. And so at this point, I think most colleges are going to stay the course.
So let me hear from Annie, Sarah Edwards, and John Gresham about this. Given the damage a successful prosecution can have, whether or not the defendant is guilty, if it's successful, he's guilty. So given the damage that can do to your reputation, to your permanent record in this case, your job prospects going forward, the fact that you may or may not be expelled and therefore you won't get a diploma, etc., why wouldn't we want to hold these proceedings to the highest beyond the reasonable doubt standard? And I'll start with you, Sarah Edwards.
So universities handle a lot of cases that could be classified as criminal cases, you know, vandalism or drug use or anything like that. And we're not a criminal prosecution. We're not putting somebody in jail, but we are trying to make sure our students learn to make better decisions and that we are keeping our campus community safe. We have the option, after we have provided notice to a student and after we've given him or her the opportunity to respond to that, to take somebody out of our university community if they're a detriment to that. And because we're not punishing them by putting them in jail, beyond a reasonable doubt really would not make sense for our community.
Just for people just joining us, Sarah Edwards is the Associate General Counsel of UNC Charlotte, so she's speaking to what University of North Carolina Charlotte does. So, Annie Clark, why wouldn't we want to hold these cases up to the highest standard, reasonable doubt, given the damage that can be done to a person's reputation and life?
So first of all, what Sarah was saying, this is a very separate system. We're talking about civil rights in a school setting. We're talking about equitable access to education. That is very separate from a criminal justice system where you're talking about potentially taking away someone's life or liberty, right? And so they should and do have different evidentiary standards. If you think about this in context of Title VII, which is employment law, if you work at a grocery store, even NPR, for example, and there is an employee complaining complaining about sexual misconduct or harassment of another employee, you are not going to wait for a police investigation to do your own internal investigation to make sure your employees are in a safe work environment. The same is true for schools and students under Title IX. Oftentimes, students who are reporting do not want to go through a long and arduous process with the criminal justice system where we know survivors end up with worse mental health outcomes and their chances of traditional justice are very slim. So a lot of times students report to the school to get academic accommodations, to move a dorm room or a chemistry class. They are reporting to continue their educational experience and to require a standard of evidence that is the same as the criminal justice system, frankly, doesn't make sense. And again, it's out of line with best practice and case law.
John?
And I don't suggest that it should be beyond a reasonable doubt. The clear and convincing standard seems to me to be the best compromise because the sanctions can be so great. And unlike Title VII or the other cases that come before a court, it is a company that will pay damages, perhaps reinstate a worker. It is entirely a different type of penalty or result than you have in these cases. And I think Annie is wrong because it clearly says in the guidance that the school may permit appeals by both parties. That's on page 2 of the DeVos letter. So let's make it clear that they haven't taken away that right. They've given the universities an opportunity.
In your experience and in your opinion, in your experience defending people who have been accused of this, under the Obama guidelines, have they worked well? Have people been wrongfully accused and wrongfully condemned with those accusations because of the Obama guidelines?
Yes, and you would be surprised at how many cases are reported each week from across the country from male students who have brought lawsuits regarding what has occurred.
Annie, what about you? Same question.
Can you repeat the question?
Sure. The question is, do you think under the Obama guidelines that there have been people who have been wrongfully accused or wrongfully convicted, for lack of a better term, of rape or sexual assault when, in fact, it didn't happen under the Obama guidelines?
It's not conviction because we're not talking about criminal court. But yes, there have been false allegations. However, those are 2 to 8%, the same as any other crime, if not lower, because sexual violence is so underreported. And so the fact that we're giving equitable weight to this other side is still very concerning. And I don't think those things happened because of the Obama guidance. And I think rolling it back is a wrong decision because if something is not working at a school, there might be an issue with the enforcement. And so that's all the more reason for the Office for Civil Rights to do their job to enforce the law rather than rolling us back to 2001. And what we were saying with the accused student appeal, yes, you're right. It doesn't require that they discriminate. It allows it.
Betsy DeVos has called this a system run amok and referred to on-campus rape proceedings under the Obama rules as kangaroo courts. Do you agree, Annie?
I think in some cases, yes. There were schools that were struggling to do the right thing, which is why this guidance was issued, to help schools better follow the law. I don't think all of this was malicious. I think a lot of it was schools did not know how to handle these cases. And so the Obama-era guidance sought to rectify a lot of that, to put in easily understandable terms some best practices. And now this new repeal and interim guidance, like I said, tips the scales not only in favor of what John was talking about, but also rapists. And so when you are accustomed to some sort of privilege, this equality that the Obama guidance was trying to set in place, the equity, and now this repeal, it starts to feel like oppression for accused students. And so, yes, I do think the pendulum is swinging the other way.
Let me say one thing that should be noted. And I will say this is the only thing that the Trump administration has done that I support. But I think Annie and the folks at the Journal would understand that the Harvard Law faculty, including most of the women on the Harvard Law faculty, the Penn Law faculty, a national letter from law faculty, and most recently, four feminist members of the Harvard Law School had said a week before DeVos came out with her first speech that the Obama regulations must change. This is not a group of folks who had some interest in male students not being held responsible. And Mike, that's the term they use, responsible, not convicted.
Okay.
That this is somehow something DeVos pulled out of the air. Those letters started in 2015 and have continued to the present.
So is this the letter in which 21 professors at leading law schools said that under the Obama administration rules, free speech and due process on campus are imperiled? Is that the letter you're talking about?
Yes, that's one of the three.
Do you agree with that?
I think due process certainly was. I again will comment that the way UNCC has handled it makes a lot of sense. Private colleges and universities have current policies that are simply abysmal.
So it sounds to me like you're on Annie Clark's side here.
No.
No?
No.
Excuse me. She's against the repeal of the Obama. Why are you against it, Annie Clark? I mean, if 21 law professors, including some women and feminists, have said the Obama rules imperil free speech and due process, why are you against it?
There are lots of other law professors who have come out and said that they are in support of it. And in fact, the notice and comment period that just closed, an overwhelming number of folks supported keeping the 2011 Dear Colleague letter in place. And as my colleague at UNCC said, a lot of schools were using this evidentiary standard before, and a lot will continue to use it afterwards.
So do you agree, John, and do you agree, Sarah Edwards, with Betsy DeVos's characterization of what's happening on campus as kangaroo courts?
It varies widely from college to university. I went to Davidson. Davidson has one of the worst policies that you could possibly have. Right across 20 miles away, UNCC has a policy. And by the way, the North Carolina legislature, 2 years after the Dear Colleague letter, passed a statute requiring that attorneys be allowed to represent the accused student. That has made a real difference. You don't find that in the private. Duke, the attorney, can't speak, but his client can write him a note, and he can write a note back. That's how some of the private schools have it. In Davidson, the attorney has to stay in a different room, and the client can ask for a recess to go ask his attorney a question. That's very strange. UNCC, all of the Chapel Hill, Appalachian, all of them have attorneys participate, and it has not, I think Sarah would agree, that has not gummed up the works.
So a kangaroo court is not how you would describe what goes on at UNC Charlotte?
No, I certainly would not.
By design? Because the others are doing kangaroo courts?
No, I mean, I think the idea is that we, even when the Obama administration came out with its guidance, we knew we were still under constitutional requirements to follow due process. And so we have been intentional about keeping those obligations as well.
Sarah Edwards is Associate General Counsel at UNC Charlotte. More to talk about with regard to these new suggested guidelines coming from the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, including why are colleges dealing with this at all? Why isn't this a matter for the criminal courts? It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Duke Energy, investing in technology designed to modernize the Carolinas energy grid over the next 10 years. More at duke-energy.com/future. And Doctors Making House Calls, physician-owned and managed. Doctors Making House Calls works to help complex patients stay healthy at home and avoid unnecessary ER visits and hospitalizations. Details available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. Well, we're talking about the Trump administration, and they'll do that again at 10 o'clock during On Point. The Trump administration announced yesterday or Monday, that was yesterday, that it would take steps to end President Barack Obama's policy to limit greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. So Tom Ashbrook and his guests talk about the repeal of the Clean Power Plan coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, CharlotteTalks@WFAE.org is a way to get an email to us. You get to us through Facebook or Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and we're coming right back.
All Things Considered on WFAE puts you in touch with people and their stories.
Before he became a best-selling author, Ishiguro was a social worker helping homeless people, and for a while he wanted to be a musician. His first two novels were set in Japan, even though at that point he had not been back.
Listen weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 for All Things Considered from NPR News and 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about how colleges and universities have been handling under the Obama administration Dear Colleague Letter guidelines and how they may have to go forward handling things differently as Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, considers rescinding those guidelines. It's open for a period of discussion at the moment. We're talking about this with Andy Clark, Executive Director and Co-Founder of End Rape on Campus, Sarah Edwards, Associate General Counsel with UNC Charlotte, John Gresham, an attorney with Tin Fulton, Walker, and Owen. They represent some male clients, have represented some male clients on the other side of this issue. And Sarah Brown has been reporting on this in the Chronicle of Higher Education. If sexual assault and rape are illegal, and they are, why aren't all of these accusations run through a court of law and handled by outside law enforcement? Why is this even a choice? If somebody has raped you, if you're accusing somebody of rape or unwanted sexual conduct, why do colleges get involved in this? You're the general counsel at UNC Charlotte. Why don't you just refer it to outside law enforcement?
Well, as we talked about before, there is a different process, different standards in the criminal process. I mean, our concern is that we
rape is rape. Doesn't matter where it occurs.
But our concern is that the effect of the rape on our campus is that students are not being able to take advantage of classes. They're not being able to fully participate in the activities that we offer.
If somebody shot a gun on your campus and wounded somebody, would you do that in-house or would you send it to criminal court?
We would probably do both, which is what we do. But
they would have to miss class to go testify in court and deal with their attorneys. What's the difference? I'm just trying to get to the difference here. What's the difference? It's a crime.
It is a crime. And the crime piece of it would be handled through the criminal process if a victim or survivor wanted to pursue that process. However, on our campus, we're dealing with the effects that it has had on our campus. We have students who can no longer participate, who can no longer receive their education, and we may have a threat to our community. And so we have to handle it as a campus.
Why can they no longer participate?
Well, because of the trauma of these situations. We have a lot of people who cannot be in class, or you know, perhaps the accuser or the accused person is in class with them, and they can't go sit three rows down from the person that they had this traumatic incident with. And the same would be true, you know, if it happened in their dorm room, we need to be able to move them to a different residence.
John, I'm trying to understand this. If you are held at gunpoint late at night outside the student union and robbed by a guy in your chemistry class, and he takes your student ID and your money and goes away, and then you know it's him, and you show up in chemistry class, and there he is, what is the difference?
Well, I think in that case, he would be locked up or on bail.
Yes, but what's the difference? That's both are crimes.
Right. And here's the situation. No one has suggested that if someone has said that they have been subject to rape or sexual assault, mm-hmm. that the school cannot take measures short of having a hearing process that separates the students. That's always in the school's purview. So I don't understand the notion that we have to have these hearings on campus. You can take action to separate people without going through that process.
Sarah Brown, is this a discussion that's even taking place on college campuses among college administrators? Why are we handling this? Is this something that's just a foregone conclusion? Of course we'll handle it. It's one of our students or two of our students.
I think most colleges know that they have an obligation under Title IX to respond and promptly and equitably to sexual assault reports. That's not a new requirement. I think it's certainly fair to say that, you know, Obama's Office for Civil Rights in the Department of Education put a lot of pressure on colleges about, you know, handling this issue, and it led them to devote a lot of resources, time, staffing, and money toward Title IX compliance. And you know, many of these colleges are cash strapped, so it was a strain on their budgets. I don't think it's really a discussion that colleges shouldn't be handling this issue, but I certainly think there is a conversation in broadly in higher ed circles about more sort of collaboration potentially with, you know, either law enforcement or other sort of outside independent groups.
Annie, one of the complaints prior to the Obama guidelines was that people were afraid to come forward because they didn't think they would be supported by the administration. So in your mind, obviously things have changed with the Obama guidelines, but in your mind, would it be better if this was handled by the law enforcement and criminal justice system as opposed to colleges and universities?
No, and I also don't think it's an either-or situation. Right now, survivors of sexual violence have the option to report to the school, the police, both, or neither. And what we know, like I said previously, about the criminal justice system, it's a long and arduous process. And a lot of survivors don't want to go through that. There are survivors who face additional barriers. If you are a person of color, if you are transgender, if you are undocumented, there are some criminal justice things that you can't simply access. And also state law varies greatly. In Alabama, for example, the state statute is it's not rape one unless it's a member of quote unquote the opposite sex and you resisted with you physically resisted. And so we've got a lot of really archaic state statutes where justice and or reporting is not even possible for a large number of folks. And so for some folks, school is the only way to report. But furthermore, a lot of students report to the school, like Sarah was explaining, under Title IX to get access to resources, to get accommodations. The police or the criminal justice system is not going to move your dorm room. And so Title IX is a law that exists so you can access your education equitably. And it's very clear, it's not debated law, that schools should be handling cases promptly and equitably and making sure school students have access to education.
So Matthew Habercorn is an attorney who represented a UC San Diego student accused of sexual misconduct. He says universities now feel compelled to find the accused responsible or victims will sue them. And then the education department will investigate the school to see what they did and they'll get fined or lose their federal financial aid. So
that's never happened. No school has ever lost their federal funding. And it's also important to note that that is not just a Title IX thing. That's an Office for Civil Rights thing. So if we're talking about any discrimination that OCR oversees, that's the case. But it has never happened.
So Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos has said that one rape is too many, but that one person denied due process is one too many. Both statements are difficult to argue with. Did the Obama administration rules deprive people of due process, John?
It did primarily, I think, in a far greater number in private colleges and universities. The state colleges and universities across the country are still subject to federal due process claims. That is not true with private colleges and universities. There is a much lower standard for any student who wants to bring any male student who feels that they were found responsible when that was simply not the case, they have a very difficult time in bringing a lawsuit. Far more, and I think that's one reason that the universities have done a far better job, the state universities and colleges.
State by state, the rules are and the laws are different, and obviously university and colleges to universities and colleges, things are going to change. Will this mean, in light of the Obama rules, a lot of states did make changes, particularly at state-operated universities, about how they were going to handle these things. Will they now have to switch things back, Sarah Brown? Are you hearing that states are worried that now they're going to have to reverse everything they did before?
No. I mean, at this point, a lot of states, not a lot of states, but a handful of states, like, you know, California, New York, for example, did enshrine certain aspects of the Obama-era policy into state law. And at this point, they're not going to change that. And so, you know, colleges in California are still going to use a preponderance of evidence standard because that's what state law requires, I mean, unless something changes. I'll also say that there are a number of federal laws that also address this. So it's not just Department of Education guidance that you know, deals with the issue of campus sexual assault. There are also federal laws like the Violence Against Women Act that were recently updated, and they contain a number of requirements for colleges in terms of how they run their disciplinary processes, and that, you know, they train all of their students, faculty, and staff in sexual assault prevention. So all of that at this point is still on the books.
So Sarah Edwards, what did North Carolina do, and what did the University of North Carolina system do as the result of the Obama guidelines? And are those changes likely to be changed yet again?
So we did not have those full-scale legislative changes that California or New York had. As John mentioned, and I don't think this was related necessarily to sexual misconduct issues, but our legislature did require that universities in the public system provide the opportunity for respondents to have attorneys in the process, fully participating. Because Title IX requires equity, we also permit complainants to have that right. Sarah was saying, the Violence Against Women Act still includes a lot of these same protections. A lot of the requirements for equality between the parties requires that we educate our students, which I think has significantly changed the culture on campus, and requires that we educate our hearing officers and our investigators and all the people involved. The Office for Civil Rights has 2001 guidance, which included a lot of these same requirements that is clearly still in place.
What hasn't changed under these proposed guidelines from Betsy DeVos?
As I said, the equality, at least through the appeal process, as was mentioned earlier, there is some flexibility now about whether only a respondent can appeal or whether both parties are able to appeal. The support that we would provide for both students has not changed. The fact that we have a Title IX coordinator who is completely responsible for all of these pieces. The fact that we have to spend a decent amount of time, and we want to spend a decent amount of time educating our students, educating our employees about these important issues, and making sure that everybody involved in the process receives annual training, because these are difficult and sensitive cases, and it's important that everybody who is involved knows what they're doing.
Sarah Brown, some say that Betsy DeVos's new rules not only reverse Obama's, but they set things back to pre-2011 times. Do they? Is that what's going to happen here if this goes through?
Practically speaking, the federal guidance on campus sexual assault policy has returned to the pre-2011 era. And all that means is that the 2011 Dear Colleague letter, as well as a follow-up piece of guidance, the 2014 Q&A, sort of that basically spelled out more clearly the obligations colleges had under Title IX. I mean, those are the things that were withdrawn. I think, again, like practically speaking on campuses, nothing has changed on the ground at this point, and we'll have to wait for the notice and comment process and for any new regulations to really see what else is going to happen.
Let me
Mike, may I say one thing? Mm-hmm. I do not suggest that there should be a rollback with regard to all of the factors about assisting students who come forward and say that they have been there'd been sexual misconduct or rape. All of that should stay in place. The thing that is important to lawyers and to law faculty is that when it comes to the hearing about whether or not a student is going to be expelled, suspended, his or her life is going to be affected, because there have been women who have been respondents in these cases, that has to change. The rest of Title IX is important. And I'm not here to suggest that Title IX should be rolled back. I'm suggesting that there must be due process at the stage where there is a hearing that brings about serious consequences to the respondent.
Andy Clark, would you disagree with that?
I would disagree, and I would actually say, yes, I would say all of Title IX is important, and if you are agreeing with this guidance, this is a rollback. Let's be really clear. This is rolling us back in time, and there are other things that we haven't even discussed yet. So, for example, the Dear Colleague letter in 2011 had a recommended 60-day time frame, so about 2 months where an investigation should be completed. This gave room for extenuating circumstances. This new guidance does not have any time frame whatsoever. There is allowance for mediation in this guidance. There is allowance for a lot of things that are harmful to survivors. And so to say that this is not a rollback, I would strongly disagree with. And also, I do want to be clear that no one on either side is arguing against fairness. That is what we want, fairness and equity. But this is a rollback, and it's tipping the scales in favor of accused students and rapists. What is not going to change are students. And if there are students or parents listening, students who have activated and organized on their campus, who have shared their stories, who have pushed their administrations to keep in best practices, those students are not going away. And so I encourage any students to use your voice to do that. And to any survivor listening who feels invalidated by the rollback of this guidance, I just want you to know that you are heard and that what happened was not your fault and you are not alone.
So the Obama administration guidelines, as Annie just said, gave you 60 days to complete investigations, etc. The new suggestion is to be reasonably prompt. That's fairly vague, one would think, but is it going to have substantial impact, John? Only have 60 seconds left.
I don't think so, and we'll wait to see if that is changed to a specific time period when the new guidelines come out.
Some of the things that have been coming in from listeners as we've been talking, Carrie from Facebook, we need to quit treating this as a male versus female issue. It is a matter of human rights. Julie on Twitter, Mike, regarding your example, facing your rapist in class the next day is not the same as facing someone who mugged you. Comment on Twitter, if you say Title IX has anything to do with rape, you dilute the meaning of the word to the point where it's meaningless. Rapists need jail. I want to thank our four panelists for being here. Sarah Brown, reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Annie Clark, executive director and co-founder of End Rape on Campus. They both joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Sarah Edwards is associate general counsel at UNC Charlotte. And John Gresham is an attorney with Tin, Fulton, Walker, and Owen. Thank you all for the hour.